This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. As Toronto's Medical Officer of Health advocates for decriminalizing small amounts of hard drugs for personal use, Fight Back got reaction from our medical record panelist doctors. There is also a decision in British Columbia to roll back decriminalization of personal illicit drug use, at least when it comes to using the drugs in public places. The concern is public safety, with an increase of violence and drug paraphernalia debris in public spaces that could hurt children or pets. Joining Libby on Wednesday, Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and medical director of the medical station in Toronto, Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre, and a former head of the BC Cancer Agency, and Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto.
It's fundamentally about being compassionate to people who have, for mental health reasons, for other dependency reasons, reached a point where they have serious drug use disorders. And unfortunately, the pushback that has come also has very legitimate reasons and behind it. And I think the loss of a feeling of public safety has been widely reported on. It exists here in Toronto. It exists in British Columbia. People feel less safe. Whether it's true or not, I think, is being debated. Whether the crime rates are truly going up or not, I think there's people who argue both sides. But the loss of public feelings of safety. And, you know, I would say at St. Mike's, unfortunately, and I want to be totally honest about this, I have at times worried a little bit about safety as well. And so I understand why the government is pushing back and moving in the opposite direction. I feel a lot of compassion for people who are suffering. This is a very tough issue.
Malcolm, you are in BC. So you've seen certainly your experience of drug use, and there are sort of no-go places. I'm just back from Vancouver.
This idea to decriminalize, I think, comes from a good place, which is that let's not treat people who are using drugs as criminals. Let's treat them as patients. They're sick people. They're addicted. And so this idea of decriminalization was that if you criminalize all this, people will do it in private. They have a risk of dying. They may not get the help they need. The challenge has been that if you're going to decriminalize, you also have to pair it with other initiatives, specifically access to treatment, prevention, control of the supply system. And what's happened in Oregon and in BC is that it's been decriminalized, but some of these other pillars, if you like, of a drug control policy have not necessarily come into place. And so what you end up with is instead of doing it in the alleys, people are now doing it in bus shelters, near schools, and I think that everyone is uneasy about that. There's not been any impact of this on the drug deaths, and it's created this feeling of public safety. So it's not surprising that people are backing away from it.
Elisa, I mean, it's not just people who are down on their luck in homeless shelters or emergency shelters. There are middle-class people who might be on your patient roster who also suffer with addiction. What's your feeling how this might affect them?
I do have patients who are you know, in their late teens or early 20s, or who are middle-aged, who use drugs, and then it becomes more of an issue of people not really using it within a public space, but the impact that it has within the family unit and how we address how we're going to get people help. And it is a challenge. I had somebody who came in and he's using cocaine and he was withdrawing in my office and we could not have a conversation, and his wife, basically they were going to get more cocaine for him because he was just so uncomfortable. And then it was going to be a matter of, okay, let's get him into a proper program that we can get him into. So I think, you know, the perception that this is in the back alleys sort of doesn't properly address that there is a significant amount of especially recreational drug use that is occurring, and people need to be aware. I had a patient that her cousin who's in her early 20s and used drugs for the first time and was found dead and is in university. So I think there really is an impact. I think people really do need to be aware of it and need to be aware of bringing up this subject with other people, with people within their family, because I think it's something that really isn't addressed until it comes to a head. And I think really everybody does need to have an awareness of the impact that drugs are having on people right now.
Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center and a former head of the BC Cancer Agency. And Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. As the province's Special Investigations Unit continues to probe that deadly wrong-way 401 crash in Whitby on Monday, the overwhelming question is, why did Durham police continue a pursuit onto the 401 going westbound in the eastbound lanes? It's been reported that the chase was called off before the suspect vehicle, connected with an LCBO armed robbery, got onto the 401 going the wrong way. What are police legally and not legally allowed to do during a high-speed chase? Libby asked this question in conversation on Wednesday with Joseph Neuberger, a criminal defense lawyer with Neuberger and Partners.
This is not going to end up well for the officers and Durham Police in this pursuit. This, you just know, if you're going to be at high speed in a chase in the opposite direction on a major highway, that there will be a crash and there will be injuries or death. You just know it's going to happen.
What's the brief? I mean, my understanding was they're not supposed to do it if there's a danger to public safety, period.
You're bang on. The Police Services Act has specific regulations about suspect apprehension pursuits. And before pursuing a suspect, the police officer or officers must make an assessment if there are alternatives available to try to apprehend the individual. And then they must also simultaneously make an assessment in order to protect public safety if the course of action that they want to take to apprehend the individual in a fleeing motor vehicle can be done in a safe manner, or if it will. In other words, it's weighing whether which is more important: trying to apprehend the individual in a fleeing motor vehicle if it outweighs the risk to public safety. So it's an analysis of if there is, in my opinion, a reasonable basis that there will be significant risk to the public. And I know these officers want to apprehend this person, but there's no way you can do an assessment in my view of this, that this would not have significant public safety risk.
Does it make a difference? It was apparently an armed robbery. Does that make
No.
a difference?
Even if, God forbid, it's a homicide, the police are still mandated to make this assessment before engaging in the pursuit and to continue to make the assessment when in pursuit if the public risk is still too great. So, there has to be this analysis regardless of the gravity of the offense. Now, the less serious the offense, the more stark this becomes. You know, if there's somebody fleeing, for example, with a child, it's a child apprehension, you think there's going to be death to the child in those circumstances, you know, then, you know, there's going to be slightly different calculus maybe, but in these circumstances, an armed robbery wouldn't make a difference.
Joseph, do you think there was some impact? Apparently, it was an off-duty cop who saw it go down. How would that play into anything?
Well, if I understand correctly, I think an officer who is off-duty still would have an obligation to try and deal with a criminal act. If they're in an unmarked cruiser, they should not be involved in any pursuit, because then it would not be readily noticeable to civilians on the highway or roads. So it should be a marked cruiser, not an unmarked cruiser. Leaving that aside, an officer who's off duty and notices would certainly have an obligation to call in and get the assistance of Durham Police. And it was Durham Police and marked police cruisers that were engaged in the pursuit. So I don't think that really moves the needle on this very much. But my analysis, I think, based upon whatever I've obtained, is that this happened rather quickly, and they were, I hope they were in communication with OPP and others, but I think to shut down the highway and get cars off of the road at that high rate of speed under those quick circumstances would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible.
Joseph Neuberger, criminal defense lawyer with Neuberger and Partners. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, U of T protesters join the anti-Israel encampment trend. We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. On Thursday, we woke up to news of an anti-Israel encampment at the University of Toronto on private property at King's College Circle. And after telling the demonstrators they would have to clear out by Thursday night, U of T decision makers told the group before the 10 p.m. deadline they could stay as long as the situation remains peaceful. Prior to that development, Libby spoke with the Tune Into the Town panel about the encampment, one of many at universities across Canada and especially in the U.S. Paula Fletcher is the city councillor for Ward 14, Toronto Danforth. Councillor James Pasternak represents Ward 6, York Centre. And David Crombie is a former mayor of Toronto, among many other accomplishments.
It's a long tradition at the University of Toronto and indeed across the country that there's students have protests, public authorities and university authorities try to make sure that it's part within the context of free speech and not of public violence. So I'm simply assuming that they're working away at doing that. Those are the parameters. They always have been, and they should be.
They've taken down fences. Presumably, there's certainly a financial cost to that, and they pitch tents, and that prevents other people from doing other things, and that's against the university policy.
If indeed it's holding people from their appointed rounds and getting an education, that's true. The university has an obligation to make sure that there's access for students who are on to other things. So how they do it is always going to be a matter of the circumstances at the time. And I can recall going back to the 60s. Indeed, I was part of a university administration at the time. It's difficult to draw the line, but the line must be drawn.
Councillor Pasternak, what do you think?
Well, look, I know hate when I see it, and these are not charter-protected rallies we're seeing across our city, gathering in our parks. What is going on at U of T is an embarrassment to the administration there, who said they would not tolerate this. They went to bed at 4 in the morning, and the protesters arrived. I've seen enormous resources, police resources, over $12 million spent trying to maintain some order in the city. I think it's a terrible precedent. It's illegal land use. Campground is forbidden there. We're going to try. I think if police are required, U of T should pay every dime of police services to clear that encampment. And I think municipal licensing and Toronto Public Health should go immediately to investigate property standards. I don't think there should be any tolerance of this. We've had 7 months of this chaos, and my office has been vandalized by these groups. Our office has been a victim of a hate crime, and I think it's a terrible blight on the city.
Paula, I'm assuming you disagree?
I think David is kind of hit the nail on the head. You know, he remembers the 60s. He was on the university administration, and it was a wild time because of the Vietnam War. Whether you supported it or didn't support it, no matter which side you support in this war, the feelings are very strong. And this thing with students and encampments appears to be all across North America. U of T is a bit late, given all what's been going on everywhere. And I think the encampment thing, Libby, I'm interested because we have all the encampments with homeless people. Having encampments now to demonstrate, I think, is a very new phenomenon. And everybody has a very difficult time. How do you deal with people that are now in tents in spaces? It's a growing problem of our age. If they're U of T students, then, you know, I just read there that they're being kicked out of the university. That's a pretty big price to pay for demonstrating, but that's what the students say they're going to do. So it's not on city property. We have a lot of encampments that we're trying to figure out how to manage those. This is U of T. They said you can't come. I guess you have to look at the fence 24 hours a day rather than tell somebody not to go over it. I'm being kind to them, but honestly, I would assume that if you say you're watching the fence, you're watching the fence.
Paula Fletcher, City Councillor for Ward 14, Toronto Danforth. Councillor James Pasternak represents Ward 6, York Centre. And David Crombie, former Toronto Mayor. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. We've all heard a lot about Ozempic, a drug that's been all over the headlines amid amazing weight loss results, as well as shortages and controversies. The makers of Ozempic say their weight loss drug Wegovy will be available to patients in Canada starting tomorrow. What is Wegovy and how does it differ from Ozempic? They both include the same medicinal property, semaglutide. On Thursday, Libby was joined for a discussion by Dr. Sean Wharton, medical director of the Wharton Medical Clinic in Burlington, a community-based internal medicine weight management clinic.
Semaglutide is the molecule, and that molecule was studied for both type 2 diabetes and for weight management. To do weight management, you need a little bit of a higher dose. So if we think of type 2 diabetes, the medication has to get to the pancreas. So you do the injection near the stomach, the pancreas is pretty close. You don't need all that much of it. But for weight management, the medication has to get to the brain, so it has further to travel. So you need a little bit of a bigger dose to travel all the way up to the brain. So when the trials were done, the Ozempic was the lower dose, and the Wegovy was the higher dose, but they're both the same molecule.
Okay, we've all heard these stories about amazing success in weight loss with the lower dose, with Ozempic.
Well, I'm not always sure that people were taking the lower dose. They may have pushed the dose up to a higher dose, right? You can take Ozempic and you can take more than just the recommended dose. You can double the dose. And that's where that off-label aspect was actually coming. So we don't recommend necessarily the off-label use. Now that the Wegovy product is here, we would recommend using the Wegovy product, which is manufactured at this higher dose. So that's what I would recommend.
It's extremely expensive. There's a big differential between the cost here in Canada and the United States. Remember, there was that case of one pharmacist who was depleting our supplies of Ozempic, sending it to the U.S. because it was triple the cost. They were like, what was it there, or is it there, $1,000 a month?
$1,000 to $1,200 U.S. dollars every month, whereas here in Canada, the Ozempic is around $250 monthly. So you can imagine that price difference is massive. So the price that we have here in Canada for both the Wegovy product and the Ozempic product is the price the rest of the world has also in the UK and South Africa. The prices of drugs in America are four times the price of the rest of the world. So it wasn't a Canada-America difference. It's an America versus the rest of the world difference.
You've talked about semaglutide as a miracle drug.
Yeah, it is a game changer. It is a miracle drug. This medication decreases disease, inflammatory diseases. So type 2 diabetes is an inflammatory disease. Coronary artery disease in the heart is inflammatory. We're even seeing renal failure as a decreasing the incidence there. So on top of that, it decreases disease. It makes you thin. So you're, and it's probably that aspect of decreasing the visceral adiposity. So in the stomach area, the fat in the stomach goes down, the inflammation goes down, and your disease is at a improved level now. So that's why it's a bit of a miracle, and it is incredible.
I talk to GPs who tell me that they are under tremendous pressure from patients who really should not be using this to get prescriptions, again, because they want to look good for their high school reunion or for a family wedding or something.
That pressure won't stop. But I think that as a GP, as a physician, I'm a physician, we are held up by our college, the College of Physicians and Surgeons. So this medication should be used for the diseases that it treats, for the indications that it treats. If you're using it for the indication, you're using it properly. If you're not using it for the indication, then you're not using it properly. So yes, there will be pressure, but we have guidance. We have medical guidance that we should follow.
Dr. Sean Wharton, Medical Director of the Wharton Medical Clinic in Burlington, a community-based internal medicine weight management clinic. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Susan in Toronto phoned about the anti-Israel encampment at the University of Toronto.
You can't compare it to the demonstrations for Vietnam. This is pure hate, anti-Semitism, and they waited too long. This has gone on for too long, and now it's become just huge, and they should have done something about it. They, the police, whoever, the government, I don't know, Trudeau, but they didn't.
Bill in Toronto phoned during our segment on the bank of mom and dad helping adult children buy a home.
My kids are going to buy homes when I pass away because of my property, right? And the thing is, I'm not selling anything to help them out now. I've got money invested for them, but the government is fighting. They're making it worse. They're making it difficult for the seniors, and they're making it difficult for the youth.
Catherine in Toronto also called in during this segment.
I have a daughter who, I would like to help her out. And I'm finding difficulty anyways trying to borrow money, even if the interest rates are 6%, you have to qualify at 9%. So it's becoming increasingly difficult. However, I'm up for helping if I need to, because how else are they going to make this move and transition into buying something for them to get into the market?
Joanne in Barrie called about what she thinks will be an unintended effect of the Loblaws boycott.
I think this is something that people are not considering. I don't think this is really going to affect Loblaws itself, but what it will affect are the employees, because they know this is coming. And they know that they won't have the sales, so they will cut hours. So all the part-time people who are minimum wage and that sort of thing, their hours will be cut.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Clay in Ajax, who phoned about that deadly wrong-way police chase on the 401 in Whitby.
why couldn't they have shut the highway off and closed the ramps so that people couldn't get off? I mean, they got to have some kind of a procedure like that. Like, I cried this morning when I heard that news, honest to God. You know, like, that's a poor mother or grand, her parent to take care of her child. Look what happens.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on Twitter at FightbackLibby and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Zeev Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.